supposing you're a new believer and you have never read the Bible before, pardon me, in your entire life. And so your pastor or whoever it is that's discipling you comes along and says, you know, the place for you to begin is to begin in the New Testament and, you know, read one of the Gospels. Let's say the Gospel of Mark or the Gospel of John. And you come along and it talks about the law, the law, the law, the law. What frame of reference do you have for the law? Well, the only law you know is the legal penal codes that you have in society that say about speeding and about paying taxes and, you know, all the laws that relate to our life here, correct? And so when unless you have some frame of reference for the Ten Commandments or Israel coming out of Egypt or any of that, really, you know, you come along and you really don't have a very good understanding about what is being said, because you don't have the familiarity of Moses. You don't have a familiarity of Israel's background, of them going into slavery, of the Exodus, of Sinai, of the disobedience in the wilderness, Kadesh Barnea, the Moab plain, of Moses going up on the mountain, of Aaron, of the sacrificial system. You don't have a frame of reference, do you? Other than you just read what you've read. And so when we come to Ezekiel chapter 15, for many of us, we don't have a frame of reference to which to understand this chapter. And so understanding that we don't have that frame of reference, I would like to read to you. It's a short chapter. It's a short chapter. There's only 8 verses in chapter 15. And so I'm going to read to you a couple other passages just to set the framework for this. And in doing so, you might want to make a note someplace in the margin of Ezekiel 15, see Psalm 80, verses 8 down through verse 16. When we get to Isaiah chapter 5, and there'll be some verses there. So you listen, and then we will come to Ezekiel chapter 15, and hopefully at that point you'll have a frame of reference by which to understand this. Thou didst remove a vine from Egypt. Thou didst drive out nations and didst plant it. Thou didst clear the ground before it, and it took deep root and filled the land. The mountains were covered with its shadows, and the cedars of God with its boughs. It was sending out its branches to the sea and its shoots to the river. Why hast thou broken down its hedges, so all who pass by that way pick its fruit? A boar from the forest eats it away, and whatever moves in the field feeds on it. O God of hosts, turn again now, we beseech thee. Look down from heaven and see and take care of this vine, even the shoot which thy right hand has planted, and on the son whom thou hast strengthened for thyself. It is burned with fire, it is cut down, they perish at the rebuke of their continence. This is just a few verses. And so bringing a vine out of Egypt, is he talking about a vine? No, it's a metaphor, it's a figure of speech. So what is he talking about? What came out of Egypt? Israel. When he planted them in the land, what happened? They spread out. They spread out to the sea, to the Mediterranean Sea, up into the mountains. They went south, they went north, they went east, they went west. They were on the Transjordan over in the Moabite area, 2.5 tribes. And the other 10 tribes were in the area that we know as the Promised Land or Palestine. And so that this is a vine that God has blessed, and its branches have gone out, and God has made it a hedge. Then we come to Isaiah chapter 5, which is about 250 to 300 years prior to Ezekiel. And Isaiah makes this prophecy in chapter 5, verses, it's a parable just like chapter 15 of Ezekiel. Now let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around and removed its stones. He planted it with choicest vines. He built a tower in the middle of it, and he hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, it produced worthless ones. So now let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. And I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. And I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, and behold, bloodshed. A cry for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. So there is this tradition of referring by metaphor and by parable, of referring to Israel as a grapevine. Jesus will do the same thing in the Gospel of John, won't he? I am the vine, and you are the branches, and a branch cannot bear fruit except it abide in the vine. And the branches that don't bear fruit will be cut off, and they will be bound together, and they will be cast into fire. So the metaphor is one we should be familiar with, isn't it? So now we come to the parable of the useless vine in Ezekiel 15, with having that at least this frame of reference with which to look and read. The word of Yahweh come unto me, saying, Son of man, what is the difference between the wood of the vine from all other trees? The vine from all other trees of the forest. If one were to take from it some wood, could they make anything out of it? If someone were to take from it, could they make a peg on which to hang any kind of a vessel? Behold, I will give it or put it into the fire for fuel. And both ends will be consumed by the fire, but the middle will be charred. Will it then be useful for anything? Behold, while it was whole, you could not make anything. So how much less when the fire has consumed it and it has been charred that you could make again anything from it? Therefore, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, as the wood of the vine among all the trees or all the wood of the forest, I have given it into the fire to be consumed. And thus I shall do to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And I will set my face against them. And from the fire, if it were to come out, then the fire would consume it. Then you will know that I am the Lord, when I set my face against it. And I will give the land or make the land to be desolate because of their unfaithful acts, declares the Lord of hosts. Once we got to chapter 8, we started seeing all kinds of idolatry that was going on in Israel, didn't we? We saw what the people were doing. We saw what they were doing in the temple. We saw how they desecrated the temple. They were called the abominations, or the abominations, the sinful abominations, the idols. Idolatry had filled the land, not only physically, but also in their heart. They had, as the last chapter said, they were making idols in their own heart. They were setting their mind after idols all along the way. And we find this continued repetition of, and they will know that I am the Lord. We saw, we've seen it the last three chapters, that he says whatever he does, the result will be that after it is done, it's been accomplished, the result will be is that the people will know I did this, that God himself has accomplished this. So when we look at a vine, just consider for a moment, what can you make out of a vine? You know, I think to myself when I was a kid going to Arkansas, back behind the outhouse there were some grapevines, and so we would look at the grapevines, we'd take off running, we'd grab a hold of them, we'd try to swing on them, and sometimes you could swing on them, and sometimes they'd just pull right out of the tree and you'd hit the ground. then we try to smoke them. I see Oscar over there. He did that too. You know, I'm not the only guy here that did it. Out behind, now Ken didn't. But out behind the outhouse, we'd light one up and we try to smoke the grapevine. Gets sicker than a dog. I don't see green, but I must have turned all shades of it because Mom knew what I'd done when she first saw me. But there's a whole host of us little, you know, skinhead kids that had done it. We were all sick as a dog, so they knew what we'd been up to. It's not good for anything. In fact, they don't even burn well. You stick them in the fire, it says both ends are burnt, and it's just charred in the middle, and you look at it, well, what can you do with this? The analogy is what can God do with these people? What use, you know, when we think about ourselves coming, and we're looking at Israel, but, you know, really the analogy comes over to us in the New Testament as well, doesn't it? Doesn't it play over into us when we come to the New Testament? Again, I just gave you a passage out of John where Jesus said, I'm the vine and you're the branches. And again, the gathering of these branches. And so when we look and we consider, there are some analogies that are parallel between them and between us. So what did we actually have to offer to the Lord in and of ourselves? Absolutely nothing. We brought nothing into this, did we? All I had to offer the Lord was my brokenness, my sin, and my strife, as the song says. Now, some of you all know the allusion to the song. He took me in my brokenness and my sin and my strife. And he made something beautiful out of our lives, didn't he? So we actually had nothing to offer to the Lord. And the only thing that's useful out of the vine is what? Out of a grapevine. What's the only thing? Can you eat the grapevine? No. You can't eat the grapevine. Even the cows won't eat the grapevine. I mean, there's just no value in the grapevine. But where is the value? In the fruit. You pick the grapes off of it, so it's the fruit that comes from the grapevine where the value is. And so the Lord, as we saw in Isaiah, the Lord came to Israel, and what was he looking for? To eat vines? No. For the fruit, to see the benefit of God's presence with them, of what he brought them out of Egypt, he planted them, he let them grow, they extended from the Mediterranean up into the mountains, they covered the land. And so in all of that, you would expect to be able to find what? Fruit, to find grapes. That's what you look for, is an abundance of grapes. Think about the land of Israel when they were describing the spies that came from Kadesh Barnea and went up into Canaan. When they came back, and it described the produce was of the land. You remember when it described them coming back with the grapes? They were so abundant, it said that they had to be carried on the shoulder of two men. That the cluster was being carried on a pole with two men to carry the cluster. They were so abundant. So what's God looking at? Here's a land that will provide everything that one would need. And so you'd expect Israel to come into a land of that nature and then for them to honor and to bless God and to see the fruit of God's presence on their lives from the produce that comes from the land. For them to honor God with their resources, with their life, with their property, with everything about themselves. And yet they did not. Instead, they worship the sun as it rises on the east. They stand at the eastern gate where God, you know, where the access for the king to come into the temple, and where the King David, the Messiah, will come in from the eastern gate, and they gaze to the east to watch the sun come up over the mountain, over the Mount of Olives. Oh, the sun. That's such a beautiful thing. And then to watch it set over the Mediterranean Sea to the west in the evening, and to see the beauty of all of that, and yet to miss the Lord in the midst of their life from the rising of the sun to its setting. And the glory of the Lord should have been there. So in and of themselves, what value do they have among any other tree? What value do they have more than any other tree? What value did Israel have versus any other nation? The Hittites, the Amorites, the Moabites, the Jebusites, you know, the Perizzites. I'm not making these names up. Go back and read in the Genesis. What value did Israel have over any of them? And the reality is none whatsoever. They had nothing more to offer than any of these other peoples. What made them distinct? The God who chose them. The God who delivered them. the God who brought them as a people out of Egypt and out of captivity and planted them in the land of Canaan. So what was God looking for from them? He's looking for fruit. He's looking for evidences that there was life. But there was none. And it describes them being taken out of the fire, as it were, to be rescued from the fire. You know, you come along and you've got a fire there, and anyone that's ever played with fire, you know, go ahead and raise your hand. Yeah, campfire guys, you know, you're not to play with fire, but, you know, you poke the stick in there and you get one out. It's charcoal on both ends. You get it out. It's all charred in the middle. You know, guys, we've all done that, haven't we? You know, you got the stick and you're just poking around. You're playing with it. Well, let me give you a couple passages. We come over to the book of Hosea for just a moment, in chapter 10, verse 1. You might write this down to look later. Israel is a luxuriant vine. He produces fruit for himself. The more his fruit, the more altars he has made. The richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars. Their heart is faithless. They now must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their sacred pillars. It didn't matter how much God invested in them and all that God had provided for them, what did they do in return? Did they honor God? No, they just made more altars. They had more idolatry. All of a sudden now we look at this and the fruit that God has given us, the produce, the reward that God has given us, we look and say, it's mine. And we begin to possess it rather than to give it back to God. Rather than to offer it back to God, we claim it as our own, as though somehow or another we have made it, and we've even made ourselves rather than God, and they gave him no glory and honor. We look at Amos chapter 4, verse 11. Now, I realize some of you aren't writing these down, and so the next time you read this, it's just going to be air in the wind, because you will, again, have no frame of reference. Amos 4, 11. I overthrew you as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And you were like a firebrand snatched from a blaze, yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. Remember the stick taken from the fire, burn at both ends, charred in the middle? God says, I snatched you from the fire. And yet, what did you do in return? You have not returned to me, declares the Lord. How many of you ever read anything from Nathaniel Hawthorne besides Scarlet Letter? Anyone here ever read anything from... One of my favorites he wrote was Nathan Brand. And it comes from this. And also Zechariah chapter 3, verse 2. The brand that's taken from the fire. Nathan Brand. Nathan means to take. It's a Hebrew word, to take. Nathan Brand. To take the brand out. And he's making allusion both to Amos chapter 4, 11, and also to Zechariah 3, 2. He says, and the Lord said to Satan, this is the first message I preached here on Sunday morning, January the 18th, 98. I haven't been here that long. But in 1998, I know you remember this, Zechariah, the high priest in Zechariah chapter 3, And it says, and the Lord said to Satan, the Lord rebuke you, Satan. Indeed, the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not the brand that's been plucked from the fire? Again, an allusion to what? Exactly what he said in Psalm 80 and what he said in Amos chapter 4, 11. And what he said here, if it burns at both ends and it's charred in the middle and I take it out, is there still any value in this? And the answer is no. Why? Because they aren't changing. It's not making any difference. And he looks at Israel through the person of the high priest, and even though God's chosen them, he looks and he says, isn't this the brand that I took out? The only value in Israel, and even in the restoration of Israel, the only value is the fact that God rescued them, that God chose them, that God is their God, because they've not been faithful. And in many ways, we haven't either. In many ways, our hearts begin to drift away from God so quickly, so easily. Robin Robinson wrote a song, and it says, it's prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, Lord. Take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. He was riding in a chariot outside of London. And a lady that was riding in the chariot with him was reading the words to this hymn. You know, if you don't read hymns, you really ought to. And she was reading the words to this hymn. And just out, you know, she just spoke out. Sometimes friends would go, what did you say? And I didn't say anything. I know I probably did because sometimes I verbalize things that are going on in my head. And so she just goes, what a wonderful, wonderful hymn. You know, this guy must really be a godly man. And Robinson had left the ministry. And his life was on the ropes. And he looks and he goes, no, I wish I could say it was true. And he said, but I feel myself that one line out of the whole hymn haunts me. Prone to wander, God, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. And we're just like Israel. You know, we take for granted the things that God has given us. We take for granted the small blessings that God gives to us. You know, some of us, we take for granted our kids. Aren't our kids a heritage from the Lord? Aren't they a gift that God gave us? And sometimes they become a distraction. They become an annoyance. They become a problem. They get in the way. You know, they cry too often. They're too needy. And yet, they're the very thing God gives us as His reward. Aren't they? I can't tell you how many dads I've heard over my lifetime. How many dads say, you know, if I ever have to change a diaper, Chris, you pay attention to this. Mark, you too. Any of you guys, any of you young guys that aren't married yet or that are married and maybe a dad, and you too, Walter, you got a little one and you've got a little one. And an honor. Because God has given them to you. And you take the privilege of serving the blessings that God has given you. You know, blessings sometimes come with great difficulty and great work and effort. So you take the time to clean them up too. Because they're yours as well as hers. And so you sit there and clean them up. And when they're barfing all over you and they throw up their milk, you know what? It's okay. You just clean it up and change your shirt and wipe up their face and give them a big old kiss anyway. Because they are a blessing from the Lord. And we look around and we begin to think somehow or another, the blessings that I have in my life, I've deserved them. They're mine. I've acquired them. It's from my own effort, my own genius, my own whatever. And we neglect that they came, all of them came from God. And the God who gave them can take them away so quickly. And they do take them away, don't they? So quickly. And so easily. So we're like the brand. We're like that stick taken out of the fire. We've been rescued. Nothing to offer. No value. We couldn't even hang it. You know, we couldn't even hang. We're not even worthy of a nail in the wall to be able to hang up something just to hang it there. No value. Yet God would choose to use us to bring Himself glory. There's no room for glory for us, is there? What's my boast? I'm a charred stick. You know, that's what I am. Burn out at both ends and charred in the middle. That's my claim to fame. That's who I am. But God rescued me and God saved me and He rescued you and He saved you and He will plant you and the fruit will come not because of who you are and what you have to offer or that you're any greater than any other wood in the forest. But for the fact of the matter, God chose you. And at the end of the day, God wanted for Israel to honor Him and to know that all that they had was from Him. If you couldn't do anything with it before it was burnt, how about after it gets burnt? If it was nothing to offer prior to being put in the fire, how much less after it comes out of the fire? And He says, and this is exactly what I'm going to do to Jerusalem, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And He did, didn't He? The city was burnt. The walls were torn down. The temple was decimated. And all the stuff in the temple was hauled away and taken to Babylon and eventually to Persia. And it scattered and wandered and never came back. All the wealth that God had brought into them, and they lost it all. And there they stand and going, why? And God said, but I set my face against them, and they will know when it all has occurred, they will know that I am God. Do we need that? In our own personal lives, do we get so out of order and so out of whack that we don't honor God in the things that we do, that it takes for God to put us through a fire? So when we get pulled out of the fire and snatched as Joshua, the high priest, or as Israel, being brought back from captivity, that we look and at that point we say, I know that He is God and I am not. Is that what it takes for us? Hopefully we're not so hard-headed and slow to learn. But we find from this parable that they were. And I have to suppose that we're not all that different than they. Let me read to you another passage. You know, sometimes I get over in the Old Testament and people, well, that was Israel, and that's then, and that didn't have anything to do with now. Just amazing. Allusions in the New Testament. And we find Paul writing to us in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. And he says about a foundation in verse 11. No one is able to lay a foundation other than that which has been laid, who is Jesus Christ. No one can lay any other foundation than the foundation that's already been poured, and that's Christ. If anyone builds upon that foundation with gold or silver or precious jewels, with wood, hay, or stubble, each will be manifest for his own works. For that day shall reveal it, because the revelation will come by fire. And each one of them, it will be a revelation of what sort of work by the testing of fire. And if anyone's work abides, which he has built upon it, then he will receive the reward. But if anyone's works are burnt down, anyone's reward or works are burnt down, he will suffer the loss. But he himself will be saved, as though through fire. And isn't that exactly what we just read? This is in Amos chapter 4, verse 11. Is this not the brand from the fire? Zechariah 3:2. Is this not the brand that was taken from the fire? It seems to me that we have the same analogy, don't we? Would you agree? If you don't agree, give me this. We can take it further. Do you agree? Same analogy, same picture. Some of you aren't sure. You don't want to stick yourself out on the, well, let me do this. It is the same analogy, exactly the same analogy. So you're safe. You can go like this. If you're still going like this, at the end of the day, you will know that He is God when He sets His face against you. But God doesn't reject Israel completely. He never did. And He doesn't reject us completely either, does He? Because it says they will be saved. And speaking of Joshua, as he stood in Zechariah chapter 3, he's got filthy clothes. He's unqualified. He is not worthy to stand in the presence. And the accuser, Satan, makes all accusations that are true and right about him. He isn't qualified. But what does the Lord God do? He takes the dirty clothes off and he removes them and he puts on new garments. And the Bible says in 1 Corinthians and Romans that God takes off our filthy garments and he puts up on us the righteous robe of Christ. So that we are now wearing a clean, worthy garment, which is Christ. We have put Christ on. We are in Christ and he is in us. And now we are dressed in him and clothed in him. So now we are acceptable. Why? Because we've done anything? No, because Christ has. Because God willingly has chosen us to pull us out and to rescue us, and he would rescue them. But I'd like you to notice, he didn't rescue them till the judgment came. Temporal judgment, not eternal judgment, temporal judgment. And isn't that really better that we get the time to change now for us to see the opportunity, even though it may be difficult for us to recognize God, and for us to turn now, instead of stand at the end of the day before him and God say, what happened? You know, I've planted you, I fertilized you, I've spent time. You know, what's the deal? I don't think it would be quite like that. That's a little mild. But I think the same gist is going to be there. What happened? I gave you everything. I made you productive. I have filled your life with my presence and my blessings. And the whole time you have turned them into idols of things that you have hung on to worship and thought somehow or another that you generated them and that they had life and grew because of you. When they don't, do they? Because the vine doesn't produce anything. The branches don't produce anything, only as they find life in the vine. Father God, as we look at the blessings that you poured out in our own lives, God, help us to realize that there is so much that you have given us. God, help us not to look at the things or even the blessings as though somehow they are an end in themselves. But let us look to your hand and to see your presence and to see your delight and see your joy, that you delight to choose us and delight to be in our life and delight to bless us and want us to look upward towards you and to give you glory and honor and power and blessing because you are worthy for all of these things and more. And to the Lamb be glory and honor and blessing and power and strength and might. And with his blood, he purchased men and women from every tribe and nation, that we should be a kingdom of priests to our God to bring you praise and glory and honor. God, raise our hearts and our minds beyond ourselves. The author and the maker and the finisher of all things. God, change our hearts. Get us out of ourselves. Get us out of our own little world and our own little picture of what life ought to be. It's a wonderful world with Jimmy Stewart and we live there. God, get us out of there. Let us see something grander, something greater, something that is eternal. That we are walking with the eternal God and we know His Son and we have life in His Son and the Spirit of God is filling us and living in us and bringing out fruit in us. God, let us look to you and not to them.